in the limelight. In terms of resources, Africa's abundance of natural resources provides long-term economic benefits for countries seeking it. The potential of the continent to develop renewable energy is immense. It is an instant attraction for Indian entrepreneurs who are looking to invest in the energy sector. We're prepared for an article written by Amira Rao, a research assistant at the Takshashila Institution, a public policy think tank based in Bangalore, India. The piece is titled, India Should Cooperate with Africa in Renewable Energy. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us for more of Amira Rao's article. Recently, India entered a strategic partnership with the International Energy Agency, IEA. The executive director of the International Energy Agency, IEA, said, India will have a critical role in shaping the world's energy and climate future. Now, India will see great potential in creating renewable energy and must partner up with other countries in this space. Africa has been seeing positive developments mainly in its solar energy expansion. The two regions seem to have a great future ahead of them and could create greater results by cooperating. South Africa and Egypt are leading the race as big solar powers in the African continent. The two are also the only countries to be part of the Solar Gigawatt Club, nations with the capacity to produce 1 gigawatt of solar power. However, according to the annual Africa Solar Outlook report of 2021, more countries, that is, Algeria, Zimbabwe, Angola, Ethiopia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Morocco and Botswana, to name a few, are hiking up their solar capacities. The potential of hydrogen is also being recognized as a crucial tool in the global solar market with a promise to meet cleaner energy goals. Other sweeping changes include the construction of floating solar panels formed by Africa's hydropower dams that could potentially double African hydropower capacity and act as a new power generation source. Hydropower accounts for about 90% of the electricity generation in smaller African nations such as Ethiopia, Mozambique and Zambia. Such developments are vital in areas that suffer from inadequate power generating capacity. After South Africa, Africa is the second largest recipient of Indian funds, with lines of credit worth nearly $10 billion reserved for projects in more than 100 countries. The Minister of External Affairs in India, Subrahmanyam Jaishankar, has also previously mentioned that India is one of the biggest investors in the African continent, amounting to about $54 billion. Such an inflow of income can contribute towards infrastructure development and finances for resources, the two biggest hindrances in Africa's renewable energy space. With considerable financial and technical assistance from India, Africa can be one of the top players in the energy field. In his 2018 speech in Uganda, one of the principles mentioned by Prime Minister Narendra Modi as part of India's engagement with Africa was the need to address challenges of climate change and adopt efficient energy sources. Cross-border energy trade is a crucial agenda of the Narendra Modi government's neighborhood first policy. India's attitude towards Africa thus reflects a long-standing commitment. The formation of new relationships indicates an increased scope for collaboration in the energy field. For example, Ghana in West Africa has expressed interest in tying up with India in the nuclear energy space and is on the lookout for investors to expand in this area. India could be a prime candidate focusing on technology sharing, supply of raw materials, availability of uranium, and the sharing of common experiences. Both India and Africa are new to nuclear technology, so a collaboration here could set the bar high for contending powers in the nuclear space. Meanwhile, in Malawi and the Gambia, India has planned to create solar power parks to meet electricity needs and demands in those countries. The project is being undertaken by one of India's largest power corporations, the National Thermal Power Corporation Limited, or NTPC. The engagement of public and private Indian enterprises in Africa is something that India should maintain to develop closer connections to the African continent and reap its benefits. Being part of international treaties like the International Solar Alliance is a massive boost for Indian-African relations and India's position as an emerging solar power in the world order. The NTPC, the National Thermal Power Corporation Limited, has already landed project management consultancy contracts for developing solar parks in Togo, eyeing opportunities in Sudan, Mozambique, Egypt, Uganda, Rwanda, and Niger, and their ISA members. Mauritius and Kenya, too, have encouraged Indian cooperation concerning solar energy. For India, the key benefit lies in reformulating its strategy to become an important influence in the African continent. As a member of the ISA, the International Solar Alliance, and helping NTPC secure energy project contracts in Africa, the main objective of New Delhi is to mobilize its presence in the region and compete against China. The International Solar Alliance, ISA, is viewed as a foreign policy tool for India to secure deeper involvement. With China ramping up its Belt and Road Initiative strategy across the African continent, the National Thermal Power Corporation Limited, NTPC, aims to try and achieve a role as a key consultant to the African member countries of ISA, the International Solar Alliance. It is also trying to lead against China in funding by setting up a World Solar Bank to achieve $50 billion annually. In terms of resources, Africa's abundance of natural resources provides long-term economic benefits for countries seeking it. The potential of the continent to develop renewable energy is immense. It is an instant attraction for Indian entrepreneurs who are looking to invest in the energy sector. Overall, with climate change ravaging the earth, the demand for green energy sources and solutions is rising now more than ever. Much more collaboration is needed among Indian and African partners. More than 25% of Africa's total energy will come from geothermal energy, hydropower energy, solar energy, and wind by 2040. It is the perfect time for India to bolster relations and work together to revise energy flow and consumption across the world.
Inside Israel.
An Israeli court ruled that any Arabic language school or funding transport for Arab school children in the northern city of Carmiel is banned. The court says that anything otherwise would alter city's demographic balance and damage its character.
Until the years 2000, maybe even less, we had students who took the final exams in Arabic. No more ever since. Students lack the motivation. For them, the Arabic language, as I see that, is related to the Arab itself. We don't like the Arab, we don't need the Arab, and we don't want the Arab. So why do we need his language? It's totally equivalent, unfortunately.
In its decision, the court cited so-called nation-state basic law. This law was passed in 2018 and caused public uproar against it, inside Israel and outside Israel, for its apartheid nature. This move is not unprecedented, but shows Israel's racist policies on the indigenous people of the land. An Israeli court has ruled that the northern city of Carmiel is a Jewish city and that Arabic language schools or funding transport for Arab school children are liable to alter city's demographic balance and damage its character. Thus, it has blocked access to schools for Arab children in the northern city of Carmiel. The court implied that facilitating this access would incentivize Palestinian Arab citizens of Israel to move into the city, thus damaging its Jewish character. This is also true for funding the transportation of Palestinian Arab children living in the city to schools and surrounding communities. The ruling came after a lawsuit which charged that the city of Carmiel was violating its obligation to provide transportation for Arab Israeli children to local schools was dismissed out of hand. In the case, the plaintiffs sued the Carmiel municipality for 25,000 shekels, approximately $7,500, for transportation expenses for two Arab siblings, a brother and sister, who were forced to travel to a school in a nearby town because there are no Arabic language schools located in the city. For years, families and activists have demanded that the Carmiel municipality fund school transportation for Israeli Arab children and has appealed to the Israeli Education Ministry to widen the map of neighboring communities associated with Carmiel school transportation program, but obviously to no avail.
The judge ruled, actually, ruling is not surprising because the goal of establishing Jewish towns in the midst of Galilee is actually to Judaize the Galilee and prevent a majority of Arabs living there. So they don't want the Arabs to feel comfortable in the mixed towns, okay? If they want to, you know, just go and live, pay, you know, property taxes and stuff, but they don't want them to establish, you know, Arabic symbols. Like, the language is one big symbol. So they refer to the national law, national bill, you know, that was put in state in 2018, which, you know, clearly states that the state of Israel is, you know, for the Jewish people, and they actually demoted the Arabic language from being an official language into a language with a special status. But that status was not defined really in a way so that anybody could come and refer to the national bill as they did in this ruling and base a ruling saying that, you know, Arabic is not, you know, a language and this is the Jewish state, and just, you know, use the basic law to, you know, to say no to any demand that has a flavor of nationality, such as the Arabic language. Like in Carmiel, here in Nazareth Elit, or as recently changed, the city, his name was changed to Nof HaGalil, we have a long struggle here for many years to establish an Arabic school in the city of Nof HaGalil, where at least, you know, according to the Ministry of Education, there's about 40% of children in this city between the ages 5 and 19 that are Arab in the city, okay? And the population of the Arabs in this city is about 30%. So far, we only have kindergartens, and starting, you know, from first grade through the 12th grade, we have to go and find solutions outside the city. With you know, an ongoing refusal. So we have been in the court since 2013. The political struggle actually started way before, like at least 15 years before. And we are actually awaiting the Supreme Court's ruling on our case. The reason, in my opinion, and my many others who are in this struggle with me, that the municipality and actually the Ministry of Education refused our request to establish an Arab school, is actually to protect and preserve the Jewish, the Jewish status in the city or the Jewish ethos. And so for them, we are only residents. We should not have any nationality rights. They don't want us to establish a community, because if you establish a school, that means you establish a community. My son will have other kids in his age living in the neighborhood, and then there will be relations between me and that child's parents, and then you will have actually a living community that grows and feels at home, more at home in the city, as opposed to just using it as like a hotel, because we all work outside, study outside, and then just come and sleep here. So there's no real community life here. So they don't want us to feel at home here. And recently they ran, people started demonstrating in front of the city municipality. First they ask for a school, and then they will ask for a mosque. Presenting actually the fact that they don't want any symbol of Arab, the Arab culture, whether it is Muslim or Christian or the language, inside the city.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. Raymond says Israel continues to steal Palestinian land on which to build illegal settlements, in the opinion of almost every nation on earth. When Israel shows its disregard for human rights and ignoring international law, it gets criticized. Citizen Jane says Israel invokes nation-state law in denying transport to Palestinian school children in Galilee. Damascus Frey said Netanyahu literally said, according to the basic nationality law we passed, Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people, and only it.
People say that we should forget about 48 and we should just start a new chapter. But what happened in 48, namely the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people, never stopped ever since 48. And therefore, we have to continue to remind ourselves that this ethnic cleansing and apartheid system is still around, and nothing changed ever since 48. And Kariel is just an example for what we all know. I mean, those who are sensitive enough for human rights know that being Palestinian or an Israeli Arab in Israel means to be a second-class citizen. Being a Jew means to be a first-class citizen.
The court based its ruling on the so-called nation-state basic law. This law was passed in 2018 and caused public uproar against it, inside Israel and outside Israel, for its apartheid nature. On July 19, 2018, the Israeli Knesset voted 62-55 to approve the Jewish Nation State Basic Law that constitutionally enshrines Jewish supremacy and the identity of Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people. This law, which has distinct apartheid characteristics, guarantees the ethnic religious character of Israel as exclusively Jewish and entrenches the privileges enjoyed by Jewish citizens, while simultaneously anchoring discrimination against the Israeli Arab minorities and legitimizing exclusion, racism, and systematic inequality. Carmiel was one of several cities and towns strategically established starting in the mid-1960s as part of an Israeli initiative to attempt to expand the Jewish presence in the Galilee, where Arabs made up most of the population. Carmiel is one of more than 700 communities the state has built for the Jewish population since Israel's founding, compared with none built for the Arab population. In March 1976, the Israeli military began confiscating and expanding several Jewish towns in the area. This was met by confrontations, including general strikes and street battles. This is known as Land Day and is commemorated every year in March.
These towns that were established in the Galilee and starting in the 50s, 60s, and on, had a clear goal, which is to Judaize the Galilee, okay, which means establishing Jewish settlements there in the midst of the Arab towns to prevent Arabic continuous territory, okay? So the language of Arabic is, you know, part of, you know, it's part of a, it's a, it's a national representation. It is, it represents the language, it represents the culture. So for them, it contradicts the goal, which is to have a Jewish-only settlement. Another aspect of this struggle is the refusal to accept that we have been here forever, okay, and that that these towns like Nofa Galil, Carmiel, Afula were all established on confiscated Arab land. So like Palestinians living in Nazareth, in Kareni, in Ain Mahl, in Iksal, all these surrounding Arab towns, they had all, like, their lands were lost by the confiscation in order to establish the city, Nofa Galil. So where, like, the official language of the municipality is that we are coming here to attain a quality of life, because there's no quality of life in neighboring cities. Well, this is obviously a sarcastic, you know, way of looking at things, because the city of Nazareth, which has double the population of Nofa Galil, is sitting on only 14 square kilometers, whereas Nofa Galil, which is half, and all on confiscated land established in 1957, is still residing on at least 33 square kilometers. So it's very normal that people living in high density will want to emigrate and move to a town which is offering more places to live in.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. David says that Israel allocated 99.7% of public land in the occupied West Bank to Israeli settlers, illegal under international law. Only 0.24% went to the Palestinians. The nation-state law embedded apartheid. Have a look at it. The simple truth is that people had to be driven off their land. Noga says Netanyahu, the nation-state lawman who made Arabic not an official language and defined only Jewish communal rights in Israel, tells the Likud, "I believe in Jabotinsky's vision that every Israeli citizen should enjoy all rights. We appeal to Arab citizens, this time vote for us." Kieran says the nation-state law turns non-Jews in Israel into second-class citizens. In the occupied territories, Palestinians are under military law, while settlers are under Israeli civil law. Apartheid in action.
Well, this is what happens when you have the concept of a settler nation. A settler nation is a nation that basically invalidates the people of the land that they wish to settle. It's ethnic cleansing. The way that, you know, we can see is that whatever the Israelis have done, or the Zionists really from the very earliest start, because, you know, my grandfather was a Zionist doctor who was kicked out of being the Zionist doctor of Palestine in Jerusalem in 1911 because he said, well, I'm a doctor, I take care of Arabs, and they said no, and they sent him away. And that's why he came to the United States. So the fact is that this is a country which has its basis in the deprivation of health, life, land to the people, and the Imperial was a beautiful place which had all kinds of gardens and parks, and it was beautiful before the Israelis took it over. But they did it as a cat's paw on the way, I think, to the northern part because it was established in 1964. In 1967 came the war where the Israelis captured Golan.
Although Arabs now constitute around 6% of Carmel's population, that is around 2,760 people, there is still no Arabic language school inside the city. As such, Arab Israeli parents are forced to send their children to various schools in the area. According to the education ministry, it doesn't take part in school organization, just the funding and content of what's being learned. It says that the money goes to municipalities and that they use it for transportation and schools. The ministry says the funding is sufficient. However, the municipalities say the funding is not. Many of them are accused of pocketing the money. This dilemma has been faced by the Arab population for decades now. It seems that Israel wants to further isolate the Arabs. At least, that is how they feel. Through decades of neglect and now political isolation, the conditions might be just getting worse.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box 19395-3. 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. The month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, Ramadan has come again, and we have been invited to fast in this blessed month. From today, you'll be listening to a special series of programs titled The Month of God. This series will consist of three parts: moralities, Islamic laws, and supplications. We hope that God will accept your and our acts of worship and prayers. Stay tuned, please. The blessed month of Ramadan has come again. According to the Islamic narrations, this month is the month of God and God's banquet for the Islamic Ummah. God receives the faithful in this month with warm hospitality. God's banquet, unlike the worldly ones, is spiritual. In fact, God tells his servants to abstain from pleasures, even the permissible ones like eating, drinking, and so on. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, Ramadan has been called such because it burns the sins. In other words, the root of the word Ramadan in Arabic means burning. The fifth infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, also says on the virtue of this blessed month, he who fasts the day in this month and spends the night in worship will be pure as the day he was born from his mother. The Prophet of Islam said on the threshold of the month of Ramadan, O people, the month of God has turned toward you with blessing, mercy, and forgiveness. It is month that is the best of months with God. Its days and nights are the best of days and months, and its hours are the best of hours. It is the month in which you have been invited to God's banquet and have been favored and dignified by him. In this month, whenever you come toward God and sit at his presence, God will accept your prayer. In this month, help the poor and the destitute, respect the elderly, be kind toward children, and visit your relatives. O people, he who makes his temperament good in this month, on the day when steps slip over the Sirat bridge, will pass over it easily. Thus, ask God with honesty, sincerity, and a pure heart to help you for fasting and recitation of the Quran, because miserable is the one who is deprived of God's mercy in this blessed and bounteous month. According to the Islamic laws, the sink of the crescent of Ramadan is possible in five ways. First, the individual sees it himself. Second, he becomes certain through hearing from others whom he trusts. third, two Jewish men say that they have seen the new moon. Fourth, the preceding month, Sha'ban, is 30 days. Fifth, the Jewish ruler of the Islamic country announces the start of the month of Ramadan. The real property and wealth of human being is supplication to God. To achieve this property requires learning the practice of the Prophet and leaders of religion. After the Prophet of Islam, his infallible successors have bequeathed to us ample concepts in the form of prayers and supplications. A considerable amount of these prayers and supplications belong to the blessed month of Ramadan. On the first eve of Ramadan, the fourth infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Sajjad, peace upon him, used to recite this prayer. Praise belongs to God who has guided us to his gratitude and made us worthy of thanking his goodness and granted us the reward of the righteous. And praise belongs to God who graced us with his religion and specialized us for his path and caused us to march in his ways of goodness, to move in them with his grace and favor toward his satisfaction. Such a praise that he accepts from us and thereby becomes pleased with us. And praise belongs to God who designated among those paths his month Ramadan, the month of fasting, the month of Islam, the month of purity, the month of trial, the month of uprising, the month in which he sent down the Quran, a guidance for people and clear proofs of guidance and differentiator of right from wrong, and for this reason clarified the superiority of this month over other month on the basis of ample respect and obvious virtues. So he forbade what is permissible in other month, and in order to revere it, he prohibited foods and drinks in it and determined the specific time limit for it, which he, the exalted and high, does not allow to be preceded or delayed. Then he made one of its nights superior over the nights of 1,000 months and called it Night of Qadr, in which angels and Ruh, the greatest angel, descend upon their Lord's commandments for every affair. And that night is healthy and blessed till dawn for any of his servants due to his ordainment that has become binding. O God, greet Muhammad and his progeny and inspire us the recognition of this month's superiority and its glorification and abstention from the forbidden acts, and assist us for fasting in it through keeping our bodily organs aloof from sins and using them in what satisfies you. Help us not to hear with our ears what is futile, and not to see with our eyes what is pervert, and not to extend our hands toward what is forbidden, and not to walk toward what you have banned. And help us so that our stomachs are not filled except with halal, and our tongues do not articulate but for what you have said. And help us so that we do not strive except for what takes us near to your reward, and so that we do not acquire except what preserves us from your punishment. Then purify all these from pretension and show off and seeking of reputation in a way that we do not associate in them anyone with you and do not pursue any purpose but you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion on the blessed month of Ramadan. What is the main philosophy of fasting in the month of Ramadan?
Our responsibility is to work hard, to avoid sins, and to put it briefly, to show piety. Piety, which has been considered as the main philosophy and goal of fasting in the month of Ramadan, means this. Piety means taking care of oneself. We should constantly take care of ourselves. Of course, primarily, I'm addressing this statement to myself. All of us are responsible. Therefore, we should appreciate the value of the month of Ramadan. We should appreciate the value of this month of Ramadan, which we are in now. Thousands of thousand months of Ramadan have come and gone throughout history. And thousands of thousand months of Ramadan will come and go during which time we are not living. Amid these billion months of Ramadan in history, we are present in a few of them. In this chain of the months of Ramadan of history, we have been given the opportunity to spend 20, 30, 50, 60 months of Ramadan from the age of Taklif until the end of our lives. So we should appreciate the value of them.
فيك الحب زاد عم العباد يا خير زاد رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان ليتك دوما قريب
Month of Ramadan draws people's attention to life after death.
One issue that is repeated in the prayers of the auspicious month of Ramadan is drawing people's attention to the worlds after this material world. The world of death, the world of the grave, the world of the judgment day, and one's difficulties in facing divine calculations and divine questioning. This is one of the issues that exist in the prayers of the auspicious month of Ramadan. Paying attention to this is very important for us officials who have certain responsibilities. A factor that helps us control and monitor this is attention to these worlds. When we understand that, not the weight of an atom becomes absent from him, the Holy Quran chapter 34 verse 3, that no small move, action, and statement will escape the eyes of divine calculators after our death, and that we will be questioned about all these things, this will deeply affect our behavior, our statements, and our moves.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden might not be building a physical border wall, but he is continuing to expand an infrastructure designed to deter migrants from crossing into the United States. Though he has distanced himself from former President Donald Trump's immigration policy, the Biden administration's plan would see the U.S. government lean into its reliance on technology at the southern border with Mexico, where Customs and Border Protection, CBP, is currently expanding one of the most ambitious surveillance systems ever created. Stay with us for the third and concluding part of an article written by Will Lennon. The piece is titled, U.S. Customs and Border Protection Plans Vast Expansion of Technology-Based Surveillance. The article has been taken from the truthout.org website. Please stay with us for the third and concluding part of Will Lennon's article. Study on migrant deaths used data from the U.S. Office of the Medical Examiner in Pima County, Arizona, who recently told Fox News Channel that a 2020 spike in border fatalities, potentially the highest death rate in a decade, could be explained in part by the fact that Arizona had its hottest year on record. A county sheriff citing construction on the border wall as another catalyst for the increase in the death rate told Fox News Channel that the phenomena reminded him of driving livestock into a canyon where they ultimately die. Paige Courage Klein, a representative of No More Deaths, told Shadow Proof of the true number of migrants who have died trying to cross into the United States from Mexico since the dawn of prevention through deterrence is unknowable. Paige Courage Klein stated, "We estimate that in Arizona there have been over 3,600 migrant deaths, but we think that's actually a third or even a tenth of the actual number of people who have disappeared and died." Adding, "What we've seen historically is that more surveillance and more enforcement technology directly results in more deaths and disappearances of the migrants." Normal Deaths is a humanitarian organization that aims to end death and suffering along the southern border with Mexico. The encampments, where they provide migrants with shelter, food, and medicine, have been repeatedly raided by Border Patrol. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, took a more ad hoc approach to border surveillance after SBINet shut down. Most notably, they worked with Elbit, a company that got its start creating surveillance systems to monitor the border between the Israeli-occupied territories and the Palestinian territories. There was greater emphasis on the construction of a physical wall than there was on surveillance during the Trump administration. Underscoring the blunt appeal of his so-called analog solution to border security, Donald Trump said at a 2019 El Paso rally, "Walls work." Even some border security groups have soured on surveillance technology. A representative for Arizona Border Recon, a paramilitary, said that the group were not fans of high technology for the border, because most of it is a waste of money. William Gein, president of the Americans for Legal Immigration PAC, also believes technology alone makes for insufficient enforcement. William Gein contended, "Lawmakers who want more technology at our borders instead of barriers and boots on the ground simply want us to watch people stream in endlessly. However, there have been enormous advances in surveillance and artificial intelligence since SBINet was scrapped in 2011. When fully implemented, Anduril Industries' towers and lattice could have a greater impact than anything that has preceded them." Paulson of Technology Inquiry said, "A major defense contractor failing in 2011 doesn't say anything about whether a software-focused company could succeed a decade later. Complicating the matter even further is the fact that some migrants may not even want to avoid being intercepted by Customs and Border Protection, CBP. In fact, according to Professor Jeremy Slack, who regularly interviews border crossers, avoiding detection is no longer the preferred bet for migrants looking to enter the United States. Professor Jeremy Slack says, "Around the end of 2018, everyone just went wholesale into asylum or asylum-adjacent migration, crossing the border, trying to flag down agents and trying to get them to take your credible fear statement," adding, "I really haven't even spoken to an individual that hasn't been trying to flag down the Border Patrol in 2 or 3 years. President Biden's administration has so far yielded plenty of good news for Anduril Industries. In a conference call around a month after Joe Biden's inauguration, a Department of Homeland Security official told journalists that border security is a priority of this administration. Meanwhile, Palantir's contract to run ICE's investigative case management system was re-upped less than a week after inauguration, indicating that the Biden administration will not shy away from using emerging technology for immigration enforcement. Since then, there has been an influx of migrants arriving at the southern border with Mexico. Anduril Industries recently bought a massive space in Orange County in what was once a Los Angeles Times printing facility. Lucky said he hoped to turn Orange County into the defense technology hub of America. Though Anduril Industries' branding is America-centric, they have shown an interest in expanding abroad, from their partnership with the United Kingdom's Royal Marines to planned participation at this year's World Border Conference in Athens, Greece. The World Border Conference is a trade show where security companies hawk emerging technologies to European governments. This year, Anduril Industries will offer a workshop on artificial intelligence and human-machine teaming. Echodyne, the company that makes the radar component of Anduril Industries' surveillance towers, will have a booth. Anduril Industries currently has around 440 employees, but plans to more than double that number by 2022. Recruiting hundreds of new Anduril employees from liberal California sounds like a daunting task. However, not everyone in the California technology sector feels the same as the Googlers who called on their company to cancel work on an artificial intelligence drone targeting system for the military. In fact, only about 5% of Google employees signed the famous letter objecting to the company's involvement in the project. Although Anduril Industries is a Trump-friendly company, Lucky donates generously to Republican political candidates and pro-Trump PACs, it is unlikely that they will have trouble doing business with the Democrats in control of Congress and the White House. Invariant, Anduril Industries' favorite lobbying firm, is run by Heather Podesta. Heather Podesta is sister-in-law to John Podesta, an influential ally of the Clintons. Jim Clyburn, The third-ranking Democrat in the House of Representatives is a noted fan of border surveillance technology, especially drones. When asked on CNN if there was a crisis at the southern border with Mexico, Jim Clyburn chuckled. Clyburn said, "We have a challenge. All our humanitarian issues are challenges for us, but no crisis." The local government of Laredo, Texas, a municipality at the center of Customs and Border Protection's border surveillance plans, met with Jim Clyburn on a legislative trip to Washington, D.C. in March of 2020, according to an agenda received in a document request. They also met with an assistant secretary for the Department of Homeland Security and a special assistant to then-President Donald Trump. A statement of work from Customs and Border Protection shows 21 surveillance towers to be delivered to the Laredo Border Patrol sector. Professor Jeremy Slack says, "Democrats have always been supportive of border build-up and border militarization," adding, "You never saw a rejection of a wall until it was kind of a centerpiece of Donald Trump's policy agenda." At a technology conference, Lucky expressed confidence that he would find support for his company on both sides of the aisle. Lucky said, "A lot of people in the United States disagree on immigration policy," claiming, "But very few people disagree with the concept of border security, especially in our government."
Around the world with reporters.
Restaurateurs, gym owners, and business people from various other industries have continued to stage protests across Italy demanding the government to immediately lift the ban on their activities. A protest dubbed Io Apro, I Open, was staged in central Rome. Hundreds of angry business people tried to head towards the parliament building but were met by police in riot gear and had to detour to nearby San Silvestro Square. Here they shouted, "Freedom, and let us get back to work," with some hurling smoke flares and other objects.
Under Italy's current red and orange zone restrictions, restaurants remain closed at night and are open for takeaway only during the day, whereas swimming pools and fitness centers are closed all day.
We are exasperated by the situation and by the way the police treat us. This is just repression. They do not even allow us to demonstrate. The government must let us return to our work. We have lost 60-70% of our earnings.
The protest turned nasty when protesters infiltrated by ultra-right activists and professional organizers of social unrest threw firecrackers and objects at police. Officers charged the protesters after they tried to breach a police cordon.
The government keeps ignoring us. My shop has been closed since October, but the rent and all bills must be paid anyway. How can we continue this way? I am afraid some people will resort to extreme acts.
Meanwhile, restrictions were eased across most of Italy after six regions were downgraded from red to orange on Monday. However, Prime Minister Mario Draghi has said Italy will have no moderate risk yellow zones this month in an attempt to keep the spread of the virus down while his government tries to step up a much-delayed vaccination campaign.